also accepts reservations for small, large, or private parties. More information is available at RadioMariaRestaurant.com.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Cross. Croft is at the controls this morning. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking about the continuing controversy, struggle, argument, discussion, debate, what have you, over immigration reform. Late last month, the Senate rejected a bill that would have meant major changes to the nation's immigration law. It is something that has been up for discussion in Washington, D.C. for at least the last couple of years. The bill that was finally put together there and was up for consideration in the Senate seemed to have something to please everyone. At least that's what the senators that were sponsoring it were trying to do. However, at the same time, it also seemed to have something to make everyone unhappy. The supporters said, among other things, that it would give undocumented workers a path to citizenship. But it was that very thing that opponents took exception to because they argued that the bill essentially amounted to an amnesty. President Bush had made immigration reform one of his top domestic issues, but it now seems that there is very little chance that this will come up again before he leaves office. In this part of the show, we'll be talking about some of the issues involved with Kathleen Campbell Walker. She is an attorney. She's also the current president of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. She chairs the immigration department of the firm of Kemp Smith LLP. They're located in El Paso, where she has practiced law for more than 21 years there on the U.S.-Mexico border. She is board certified in immigration and nationality law by the Texas Board of Legal Specialization. And her practice includes all areas of immigration law. She also serves as chair of the Immigration and Nationality Law Board Certification Exam Committee for the State Bar of Texas, as well as on the State Bar Advisory Committee. And this is an issue that she's spoken on quite a lot. She has appeared on television, interviewed on this subject. She has appeared before Congress, and we're pleased that she could spend a little bit of time with us this morning. Questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of people who call in is that people are brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving along and get in as many different callers as possible. Certainly, though, callers are welcome with their questions and their comments. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number to call is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. Again, for Champaign-Urbana folks, local listeners, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Ms. Walker, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure.
There are a number of things that I want to try to talk about, and perhaps in some detail, the various provisions of this bill and of the proposal that was not successful, and who all is involved in this debate, and what it is that people want, and why it is that it seems that we can't really quite manage to satisfy everybody, and in the process, maybe not satisfying anybody. Let me just ask you a basic question. It seems now, at least everything that I read after this went down to defeat in the Senate, says that as far as everybody seems to be concerned, is that for now, probably for the rest of the Bush presidency, maybe even sometime into the term of the next president, this issue is just gone. It's just dead. Do you think that probably is right?
It seems to be a realistic assessment, David. I just got back from D.C. We had our Leadership Institute for the American Immigration Lawyers Association, and we were back up on the Hill. And basically what we're being told is that those who were part of the grand bargain had to give away quite a bit in order to get on the grand bargain table and are pretty much fed up with the process. And on the flip side, those that might want to come back and try to piecemeal things like a dream bill or ag jobs or some type of H-1B relief, there are really not many people that are willing to take up just those compartmentalized kinds of approaches. So many are looking now to 2009, basically. So we'll see, but it doesn't look good at the moment.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the grand bargain, because it seemed that, as I said, and as the way I looked at it, the hope here of the people who were putting this this together, the hope is that you could find, you could build enough into this bill so that you could find something for everybody to support that would make happy both those people who say that it's a fact of life that we have something like 12 million undocumented people and here in this country, and that what we need to do is create a way for them to become legal. At the same time, there are also those people who say, well, you know, what we've got here is a real law enforcement problem. We need to put more pressure on employers to make sure they hire people who are legal. We need to beef up security on the border. And so we ended up with a package where everything there was stuffed in there. So you could find something. So I can imagine, you know, no matter where you were in this debate, you could find something in there. You could say, all right, this particular provision here, I'm for that. But then also there's going to be some provision over here. You're going to say, but this one over here, no, I can't live with that. And I guess I'm not exactly sure why they thought that such a thing could actually pass.
Well, I mean, after 9/11, of course there was the impetus to have increased enforcement mechanisms. But what we've seen over the past 10, 15 years, I mean, I've been sitting here on the border in El Paso and focus on cross-border issues and security issues, and I can say that the more boots you put on the ground, the more sensors you have, the more aerial drones, et cetera, those efforts, while laudable to some degree, are not the solution. So when you try to have people saying, we want triggers, which is what the Senate bill had in it, certain triggers on enforcement mechanisms that had to be met. I mean, you could already see in the way that the triggers were couched, based on prior experience, that they weren't going to be met. But Secretary Chertoff was basically willing to say that he was going to reach certain benchmarks and say in an 18-month time frame the triggers had been met to allow the rest of the bill to go ahead and be facilitated. But bottom line, people know that to actually make this work, you've got to have both sides of the equation. One is the enforcement mechanism, certainly, but it has to be funded and then properly followed up on and hold people accountable for their actions. And then on the flip side, well, we do have employers who are unable to tie into the legal system right now to be able to employ needed workers, where you're able to establish that, nope, I can't employ them through our current legal system. So, yeah, I mean, the problem is that was the push to go ahead and say, we're going to gut it up and say we need a comprehensive solution. We need both sides of the equation to be effective, and we had the history to show that the enforcement side alone had not been successful.
Yeah, and just to make sure people understand what you talk about trigger, what the provision that was built into this said was that we're going to do these other things, and we'll talk about them. We're going to have the guest worker program. We're going to do something to try to make it possible for people who are here illegally to become legal, but to satisfy those people who said, well, we've really got a border security issue here. The trigger that was built into this was that we're going to hire a whole lot of new border guards. We're going to put up a lot of new fencing. So we're going to do all of that first. That would have to be in place first before these other aspects of the program could come into effect. So in fact, what that was a provision to try to make happy those people who said, no, the big problem here is border security.
Right. I mean, I can say, though, as you know, focusing on border security, that some of the objectives, though, were really not attainable, but, you know, fine. Yeah. That was the architecture.
Right. Let's talk then about the, it seemed to me that the biggest sticking point of all, and you can tell me whether you think this is true, continues to be, was and is, what it is that we do about these 12 million folks who are here illegally, who are undocumented. And the big sticking point was between those people who said, it's a fact of life, we have to deal with it, we don't, even if we wanted to, we don't have the resources to round everybody up and send them back where they came from. This is something we're just going to have to deal with. We need their labor. It makes sense to make some kind of way for those people to become legal and perhaps eventually to become citizens. And on the other side were those people who said, no, this is a simple, straightforward law and order issue. They broke the law coming here. they should be sanctioned for breaking the law, and anything short of that amounts to amnesty. And it seemed that those people, that view prevailed, or at least that there was a lot of public support for a view like that. And it seemed to me that was the biggest problem of all. How do you resolve that? Now, having said all that, I guess the question is it possible to design some kind of program to address that issue and make it possible for people who are illegal to eventually become legal, and yet have it not look like, sound like, amount to an amnesty? And is there any way that you're going to make happy those people who say, nope, they broke the law, that's it, end of the story, we should deport them?
I think it's really interesting how we have, throughout our system, our legal system, whether it be criminal or civil, the use of discretion is a part and parcel of how we enforce laws. When you look at prosecutorial discretion, is the phrase, in the context of somebody who, let's take the simple example, somebody who came into the United States between the ports of entry, and then they're working illegally, whatever in whatever capacity, whether it be on a ranch or on a farm or in a hospital or in a restaurant or a hotel. And we're going to say that there is absolutely no ability to use discretion to make decisions regarding whatever the punishment is for those people. For individuals who feel that no punishment will suffice, I don't see how you ever address this question. But what I do not also understand is why we are so inconsistent in this context. Because what is enough? They were already going to be paying massive penalties, being placed in the back of the line, waiting over 13 years at least. And in addition to that, it didn't apply to people who could not exhibit certain, you know, elements of good moral character and lack of criminal record. All of that's built in. The assimilation requirements, all of this stuff is built in. And in addition to that, they were forced to do a touch back outside of the United States. And yet, that still wasn't enough. Mm-hmm. So I am at a loss in being able to sate people that there is no penalty that can be paid, and I'm just curious why on earth we hold people who cross into the United States illegally to work with more vehemence regarding their violation than so many other individuals who violate criminal laws in our society. Yeah. And that's not even a criminal law in an immigration context. It's just it's a misdemeanor on illegal entry is what it is.
Well, it sounds, you know, as you say, what was being discussed was a kind of a program where these people who are here illegally could apply for legal status, but they'd have to pay a fine, there'd be a processing fee, they'd have to show that they've been employed, that they don't have a criminal record, all that sort of stuff.
Right.
So then people who were supporting this could say, well, look, we're not just giving these people a free pass.
Right.
There are some sanctions there. They're going to have to pay a fine. We want to make certain that they haven't been in trouble, that they're good, honest, solid folks who are here to work and are going to become good American citizens and so forth. That was built in to try to make that more acceptable. I guess I still feel that no matter, you know, we could have another president, another administration, we could go another couple of years, but that we're still going to get, as you say, we're still going to get hung up here if there are still people who take that maximalist position and say, well, I don't care what you do. I'm not going to back off that idea of anything like this. That's still, as far as I'm concerned, that's amnesty, and that's not going to go. It sounds as if that's, no matter what else we do, that's going to be the thing we keep tripping over and the thing that's going to be the most difficult to deal with.
Agreed entirely, and what we're left with now is this vacuum that's been created because we managed not to get anything through. Well, so now who's stepping into the vacuum? What we have are states and local municipalities stepping in on the immigration issue, which is typically something that is, you know, a federal preemption situation, mm-hmm. And now what we have is this proliferation of trying to create such a hostile environment, as hostile as we can possibly make it, So the hope is that people will leave. And this is something that was, you know, to me very interesting when I compare it back to 1986, before the Immigration Reform and Control Act was passed, which contained the legalization provisions that did make it through Congress. And what was happening back then, you had Senator Simpson from Wyoming, who was one of the architects of that bill. He was quoted in an article that several different articles, and then his own article that he wrote in a law review I read, where he was saying, I'm not willing to not act because I can't imagine a United States to be created by our lack of action that would be hostile to basically these people in the community. And it's very difficult to be able to look at somebody across the street and figure out legal or not legal. But now you have Prince William County, for example, trying to drill down and figure out every single public benefit that the county might be providing to anyone, and then a line item on every single one trying to figure out a way to make sure and deny any benefit to somebody who is not here in documented status, no matter the age.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's I'm interested in that aspect as well, because I think that, as you say, what happened immediately after when this was defeated in the Senate, a lot of people were saying, well, you know, now what's going to happen is exactly what you have pointed at, is that states and localities are going to start saying, well, the Congress is not going to deal with this, so we're going to have to deal with it. And the very first thing, within days, the state of Arizona, the governor signed new legislation that would impose very severe penalties on employers for employing someone who was illegal. And the first time you could get your business license suspended, and the second time you could get your license revoked. So that would mean that if you knowingly did that twice, or it could be established, maybe not even knowingly, that you did it, you could be put out of business. And now, so it sounds as if that it indeed has what was predicted to happen has indeed happened, that a lot of local, state and local governments are saying, well, we're going to have to deal with this now, and you're going to get this kind of thing where everywhere you go, somehow the approach and the regulations are going to be different.
Oh, that's right. I mean, you're going to have a whole new treatise on local immigration law. I mean, it's hard enough. Immigration law is known as being one of the most complex areas. I mean, we deal with Department of Labor, Department of Homeland Security, Department of State, and then we have associated issues with Social Security Administration, et cetera. And of course, that's now within the American Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators with Real ID seeping into driver's licenses on this issue of what is immigration status. And we do not have a quick, ready database accessible for that purpose, or for that matter, for employers to tap into to figure out immigration status. Because if you've got somebody using someone else's real Social Security card, the system doesn't pick it up. So this issue is just as anticipated, and was already on the path before the cloture vote on comprehensive reform in the Senate. It's just proliferating.
Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest for anyone who might have tuned in the last 5 or 10 minutes or more. We're talking with Kathleen Campbell Walker. She is an attorney. She specializes in immigration law. She chairs the immigration department of the firm of Kemp Smith LLP in El Paso, where she's practiced law for more than 21 years. She also currently serves as president of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. And we're talking about immigration reform, some of the debate that's been going on now for some time in Washington, and the recent proposal that was up for consideration in the Senate but was defeated. And as we have said, there are a lot of people who predict that probably this issue is dead for the moment and will not come up again until after the next new president, whoever that person is, takes office in 2009. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I wanted to, you talking just a little bit about this issue of putting the onus on employers, and I think that there are probably a lot of people who have simply said, well, the way to deal with this problem really is that we need to require employers to make certain that before they hire somebody, that person is here legally, and then impose tough sanctions on the employers if they hire somebody either knowingly or unknowingly who's illegal. And I think the idea is that there was a proposal that, well, we'd set up some kind of a national database to make it possible for employers to do that. And then that also, though, leads to a number of questions about the adequacy of a program like that, how well it would work, what kind of resources that we're putting into that, creating that database. It sounds as if that's really not to say that by requiring employers to make certain that the people that they hire are legal, it's going to take care of the problem. It sounds as if that's just not realistic.
Well, it makes a nice soundbite, and it gives you some comfort to say, oh, all I have to do is just indicate employers are supposed to make sure that this is going to be followed. But the issue is that since 1986, when we started the whole employer sanctions and then the flip side of that, avoiding discrimination based on immigration status issues, that it has been problematic to be able, and that would be a very low-key statement, to be able to come up with a database that an employer could bounce an electronic query on and have an answer that's accurate within a matter of a few seconds. Oh, yes, this person is indeed eligible to work. And the big deal has been you've got two sides of the equation. One is that the employer is being held to that of a reasonable person standard when they look at these physical documents to establish identity and work authorization. Fine, but you certainly do not want them to be at the level of some forensic expert in trying to figure out, is this a fraud document or not? So let's figure out some reasonable ground. Then what was happening was the Department of Homeland Security with Social Security Administration created the pilot program where I can voluntarily cooperate, send in Social Security numbers if that's indeed what I receive, or information regarding somebody's work authorization from the Citizenship and Immigration Services office and say, okay, this person's authorized to work. Again, the problem is that without some kind of biometric link, you don't really know if that is the document issued to that individual.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got to deal with this baseline. Do we go ahead and, as is proposed in legislation, have the Social Security card basically become our national ID? It really is to a certain degree, but it's not an identity document as it stands right now. All it is a number with a name on it. So the push to have the photograph or the print or whatever for the Social Security card, it's something that we have not been comfortable with as a nation to have a national ID card, and that's where you start walking down that path on the biometric tied to the person for work authorization.
Yeah. I suppose I even find myself wondering if you're talking about a system like that where there would be even a reliable national database for employers to check,
mm-hmm.
whether, you know, when you'd think about how many times every day somebody would do that, whether what it would take to design a system that would be robust enough so that it would even supply the information, assuming that it was reliable.
Agreed entirely, and that's the problem. We're so far. I mean, it doesn't mean that it isn't a good objective.
Mm.
I mean, if that's how you believe you're going to be able to deal with enforcement on this issue in the best manner. But the problem is, if you look where we are right now and the number of employers who even participate in this not-so-hot, not-so-accurate employment verification system through Homeland Security and Social Security Administration, we've got a long way to go.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have several callers here to bring into the conversation. Well, why don't we do that? We'll start out with someone who is listening in Champaign, and that is line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
This is really a critical issue. And we're discussing it as if there were a lot of different options for dealing with it, but do we in fact have the capability of locating and actually rounding up all of these illegal immigrants? Because if we don't, a lot of what we're talking about is moot. And I just am going to hang up here and listen. Thanks.
All right. Well, thank you. Well, what about that?
Well, I really appreciate the question. The issue is once you have somebody that comes into the United States illegally or legally for that matter, I mean, we all don't really want to have some type of GPS chip implanted in our bodies. So in trying to be able to locate someone within the United States it's not a simple matter. And do we want to create this community of basically fear all the time, where people are like, who's going to be out to get me? So I agree that it's a real problem on A, being able to identify the individuals, and no, I don't believe we have the capacity to do that at the moment, nor am I sure that I really want to try to fix the problem that way. But on, that's why the issue of the phrase bringing people out of the shadows was utilized during the comprehensive reform debate, something that would give people a reason to become part of the system and at the same time give employers a more realistic method to force them to at least use it in order to check work authorization. Still not might not be perfect, but it would get you on the path. I don't know if y'all remember, but way back when, after World War II, there was an operation trying to create a community of fear and rounding up people where the, at that time, INS was in concert with agricultural workers to round people up, put them on trains, and ship them out. It was a really... nobody really cared about checking into your status. It was more like you were, you looked like you fit into the equation, and then you were just shipped out. And I don't. I hope and pray that we're not willing to go down that path.
All right, let's talk next with someone in Mahomet. This is line number three. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I think it is really a complicated issue, but first of all, you have to shut off the flow of illegals into the country on all sides, and then make a plan that deals with the people who are already inside the country. I don't see how you can get around that. Otherwise, any plan that gives illegals a way of getting citizenship is an open invitation for more illegal immigrants. And I'll just listen to your reply
okay.
there.
Well, that in fact, yeah, we did talk about the fact that initially the built into this whole big, very complicated plan was an attempt to do essentially to do that. People said, okay, well, before all any of this other stuff goes into effect, what we're going to do is beef up border security. Of course, then I suppose the question is, well, even if they did, they were talking about hiring 20,000 new guards and putting in 370 miles of new fencing. And I suppose then that gets you to the question of, would that be adequate? Would that do it? Or would we still have a problem of people who were willing to take the risks and do whatever it would take to try to come into the country?
And I think historically what it will show you is we've been working on that approach for over 10 years. On allegedly trying to get control of the borders and putting more boots on the ground, more aerial drones, more sensors, yada-da-yada-da. But we don't have sufficient Border Patrol staffing still. And at the same time, we've had fencing, for example, in El Paso. We were part of Operation Hold the Line. Our congressman used to be a Border Patrol chief. Operation Hold the Line did put up a fence through El Paso, between El Paso and Ciudad Juarez. It helped to a degree within this community, but it didn't resolve the problem because then it just increased the fees that people were paying to smugglers to get them across outside the fence or under the fence or over the fence. So it's more than just enforcement to get it fixed, in my opinion.
Let us go again to another call. I think this would be someone in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Yeah, hello. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine who is an immigration lawyer in Princeton, New Jersey, and I frequently talk about these things. And one of the things that he said, it was a statistic that I heard that I haven't seen printed a lot, is that approximately a third of the current illegals actually entered the country legally. Now, has there been any discussion about a different legalistic approach toward those people who entered the country legally versus those who entered the country illegally?
I thank you for at least splitting the two populations apart. You'll hear a lot of information about the, and I don't know that I agree with the one-third because we still don't even know.
It's an estimate, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a ballpark on somebody's idea, but bottom line, that's the point that you, I believe, are addressing with an overstay. Somebody who got a visa, somebody who presented themselves at a port, and now they're here longer than their period of authorized stay on the I-94 document. Part of the effort on the overstay was to try to, since, gosh, it was back in 1986, they had Section 110. Section 110 of IRCA, the Immigration Reform and Control Act, is what is the precursor to, I don't know if you've read about it, the U.S. Visit Program. U.S. Visit is where we're being charged with tracking every single person who comes into the United States and when they leave. One of the objectives was, of U.S. Visit was to try to deal with exit control and tracking entry. If you've read the reports that have been done on U.S. Visit, you'll see that they have not been able to come up with a way to deal with exit control, even in a controlled environment like at the airports. And as far as entry control, the good thing that has happened is that they are, at the time of visa application, actually tying a biometric two-print to the person's information they're providing to the consular officer on the visa, and then that's verified when they come legally into the U.S. So it's a starting point on having a stronger control on the identity of people coming in. But again, we're a long way from dealing with knowing the moment someone is an overstay, where they are, A, and then taking any action on it.
I just think there's a stereotype that every illegal immigrant entered the country illegally, and that's not true.
That's correct, and the term illegal is also problematic because an overstay is a civil violation subjecting the person to removal from the United States. Someone who crosses into the U.S. illegally is a violation of, if we want to get technical, 8 U.S.C. 1325, which is a criminal misdemeanor. Hence, you know, is illegality both in a civil and criminal context.
Yeah, you have an immediate difference in the illegal status, yeah.
Yeah.
Very good. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. And let's continue. We'll talk with someone else here. This is a listener in Urbana, where we are, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I'm wondering about the smuggler's fee thing. I don't know how prevalent this is, but, you know, I hear numbers 3,000, 5,000 on up. And I guess I just wonder, I don't know how many people in this country have, like, sort of $5,000 extra cash. And it just seems very odd to me that someone who is making such a small subsistence living could come up with this kind of money. And I really wonder if it's not somehow subsidized by the people they're coming to work for.
I have, in some cases, you know, when you have employers that are actually engaged in smuggling operations, there are different criminal provisions against that type of operation. But just to give you an example of people that don't really have that much money coming up with the money to be able to hire a smuggler, or a coyote is what they call them here on the southern border, among other phrases that I cannot repeat in public. But what will happen is a community or family will basically come up with the money collectively to send people over. I mean, in China, it's not uncommon for the amount to be, you know, 10, 15, 20 grand.
Caller, does that get at your question?
Well, I mean, I guess, you know, like even an extended family, it seems to me that when you're living at the kind of wages that Mexicans are on average live at, that it, even there, it seems to me to come up with that kind of money is quite amazing.
Well, and certainly in some cases what you also have is someone who is working a deal so that if I find you for a particular employer, let's go ahead and, not that I'm saying that this necessarily is permeating the agricultural industry, but let me just take an example. I'm an ABC recruiter down in Mexico, and I'm going to be able to take money back from you. You're going to work and pay me back because I helped you get into the U.S.
So it sounds like it's in fact a form of indentured servitude.
You got it.
Yeah,
you got it.
Let me just ask you about another provision that we hadn't really talked about, and that is again as part of this grand bargain. One of the things that was up for consideration was what amounts to the creation of a guest worker program.
Mm.
That is up to 200,000 guest workers a year could apply for special work visas. They would be good for 2 years. They would be renewable up to 3 times, but in between, the person would have to return to their country of origin for a year between each stay. And at one point, I think the number here that was up for consideration is the number of available visas every year was twice that many, was 400,000.
Right. Senator Benningman dropped it down.
And it was dropped down, and the argument is that these, and that is one of the arguments that has been made against allowing this kind of program to exist, that these workers are taking the jobs of American workers. And so that's why that was the response. They said, okay, fine, we'll not make it 400,000. We'll make it 200,000. We'll just cut it in half. Is there really reason to believe that significant numbers of people who are coming here undocumented, coming here looking for work, are in fact taking jobs away from American citizens? Does that really hold up?
The way that the Y was going to be set up is again, it was going to be tied into establishing the need for the worker. I mean, and you're not just going into it blindly. But what's always happened is that you'll have, like, the AFL-CIO would be in favor of dealing with the undocumented worker, but not in favor of dealing with the Y temporary flow worker. And so we've got this also very strong pushback with different segments of the unions within the United States. The SEIU would be okay with the Ys, but AFL-CIO was not. To me, the fundamental question is, if you have, and usually the Y, it was segmented to favor the agricultural industry, and it also was incorporating ag jobs to a degree as well. If you have indeed established that you cannot find the people to pick the grapes, or you can't find the people to pick the lettuce, and you have indeed seen this employer put out ads offering XYZ a wage and people are not responding, one side of the equation will say, well, all you have to do is raise the wage and these jobs will be filled. On the flip side, will they buy your product then at Walmart at XYZ price, which is higher because of that wage? So it's a real cyclical argument.
Mm-hmm.
And what I thought the bill was doing from a Y perspective was that, no, it wasn't opening up the floodgates to people that were basically taking away jobs, as they would state it, from U.S. workers who are willing to take those jobs.
We have about 10 minutes left, a little bit more, in this part of Focus 580. And I have another caller, and I will get to them in just a moment. But I would like once again to introduce again our guest, Kathleen Campbell Walker. She is an attorney, specializes in immigration law. She is chair of the immigration department of the firm of Kemp Smith LLP in El Paso, where she's practiced for more than 21 years. Her practice includes all areas of immigration law, has a special focus on things like consular processing, admissions, cross-border business immigration, waivers, security checks. She is currently president of the American Immigration Lawyers Association, and we're talking about the debate, which has been going on some time now in Washington, on immigration reform and the potential, the possibility, the need to change the nation's immigration laws. There was a package, a rather comprehensive package, designed to try to please enough members of the Senate to get it to pass, that was up for discussion near the end of last month. However, it failed. And now many people expect that this issue is dead now, for at least for the rest of the Bush presidency, certainly into the next administration, whoever that would be. Questions here are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. The next caller is in Gibson City, not all that far from here, line number two.
Yes, hello. Yes, I really appreciate your guest, Kathleen, and I guess I just want to comment on, I was in San Jose, California, the week of 4th of July week, and it was very interesting. All the people that were at the hotel were Hispanic, all the people, that the ladies that did their housekeeping were Hispanic. They were working on the place we stayed, and the contractors were workers were Hispanic, and it really opened up my eyes. And the other thing I want Kathleen to comment on is, why are people coming across? What does our large corporate America have to do with this? Our military aid to Central and South America. I mean, I think our history, we forget to look back at history and look at And I guess also NAFTA, what that has done to our, you know, crossing the borders. And I'll hang up and listen. And thank you for your work.
All right.
Thank you for the kind words. I mean, I'm sure that you've heard from a NAFTA perspective the argument is made that in some cases what happened was is that the Mexican industry was not protected enough, and so that some of the jobs were taken away, and hence people needed to go ahead and find employment, and that was a driver for some Mexican nationals. But I've got to tell you that, I mean, I'm sitting here on the border and deal with the maquiladora industry quite a bit, and that's where I know that U.S. companies who have headed down to Mexico have created thousands of jobs in which Mexican nationals are being employed. In addition to that, I can tell you that we also represent companies that are engaged in agricultural production, and even the growers' associations in the state of Texas are stating if we don't get the ability to bring workers into the United States lawfully, what we're going to be left with doing is going into Mexico, for example, and growing product there. So we have people that are growing all sorts of products in Mexico because they can easily have a labor resource. And I don't know if you all saw recently Microsoft on the higher skilled level being unable to go ahead and have sufficient visa numbers for higher skilled workers, just put over, I guess it's now going up upwards of 300 jobs out of Washington State into Canada. So we live in this global community, and employers need to be able to find workers through legal means. And that's just basically what we've got to accomplish here, period. For the good of the nation.
Just real quickly, another one of the provisions here in this package that had been up for consideration in the Senate was a change in the way that we evaluate people who are asking for citizenship.
Oh, yeah.
Moving away from perhaps just the idea that says, well, one of the most important things is, do you already have family in the United States? That if you did, and the answer was yes, well, then that counted in your favor. Now what they were talking about, at least, was a kind of a system that would evaluate, take into consideration more aspects of that individual, particularly what kind of education they had and what sort of job skills they had, and that way you could accumulate points, and so we were going to a kind of a point system. Do you think that that's something actually that would be good or better than what we had done before, or are there some problems involved with that?
Well, I mean, in fact, when you were saying earlier the big problem was about the undocumented. Obviously, that was the largest gorilla in the House. Mm-hmm. But something that was created within this new bill that was not in the Senate Bill 2611 from the prior Congress was the point system that you raised. And basically what it did was just decimate family-based immigration, and on top of that, delinked the employer from the equation for legal employment-based immigration. So if I need a person with this skill set, and I've identified that person, then I don't get to choose that person if I've tested the labor market and established that I can't find anybody else who meets the minimum requirements for the job. Now I'm going to be just, you know, whomever comes to me. I don't have that choice anymore. So it was a tremendous problem. I mean, basically it was 47 points for employment, 28 for education, now I need my glasses, 15 for English and civics, and 10 for extended family. And the way that it played out, though, was almost like one of our old national quota systems, where you focused on where the person was coming from. The reason why is because there was so much focus on education and the higher skilled kind of position that those who might fill in or needed unskilled positions, those who are in the hotels and the restaurants and the construction workers, et cetera, wouldn't be able to come up with enough points. And history has shown that typically the educational level of those coming from Central America or Mexico is lower. So it was going to favor, for example, immigrants from India and the Philippines and South Korea. So for me, it was a major problem with the delinkage and the from the employer. And in addition to that, even in places where you have a successful point system, like, for example, Australia, they specifically still reserve numbers for family-based immigration. And let's think about our brethren to the north in Canada. Those people who do not have degrees would have a problem under the point system, for example, Mr. Gates from Microsoft. But on top of that, you would have a problem with, like, a PhD, fine, would be able to get in, but then the job wouldn't necessarily be there for them. So it created a whole host of new problems.
Okay. We have a couple of minutes left. I have a number of callers. We'll try to get in as many as we can. I don't imagine we can do all of them, but we'll see if we can do at least one or two. The next in line is Champagne in line one. Hello.
Yes, I don't want to talk about Bill Gates. I want to talk about how this immigration system presently in place and how it affects people whose racial group, predominantly all citizens who've been here for 400 years, who basically for a variety of reasons work in low-skill, low-income jobs, African-Americans, how they have been impacted by this system of illegal immigration. You talk about hotels, restaurants, domestic work, you name it. That's where African-Americans have basically worked, and they will do this work provided the pay is right. And I really get upset when President Bush and others say we need these people to come in because they'll do work that Americans won't do. Sure, they'll do work that Americans won't do for that exploitative wage. And I really think that that group of people, as they all in all debates, African-Americans who built this country in large measure, are tended to be forgotten when we talk about stemming the tide of illegal immigration. I'd like to hear you comment on that.
Thank you. It's a great question, and I've had to deal with this one before, and it's excellent. I was on Bev Smith's program down in Florida, and she specifically speaks to African-American community issues, and we were discussing this particular point. And one thing is that, the issue on what is the wage that's going to be paid for a particular type of work is extremely relevant, but also, you know, what are people going to pay for the product is also relevant, and that it is in the interest, assuming that a percentage of the African-American community focuses on lower-skilled jobs, that it's not to the best interest of the African-American community to have a segment of society out there that's working underground. I mean, bottom line, we need to be in control of establishing whether or not the person is documented or not, and whether or not the employer is meeting the requirements they're required to in order to establish a labor need. So it's to all of our best interest to make sure that higher-skilled and lower-skilled jobs are based on a legal system that evaluates the labor market properly, and that's what we really don't have going on right now.
Okay, thank you.
All right,
thank
we'll
you so
talk
much.
Next to somebody who is no doubt on the road, driving on a cell phone on line number three. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Hi, I just want to say your guest is probably the best informed person I've heard on this issue in all the months of wrangling over this issue. I had a question. It's something that's puzzled me a little bit, and it involves the issue of documentation and whether employers really are going to have the capability to be able to check on the status of workers they might want to hire. Isn't there some way that could be linked to the passport system or a revamped passport system? I mean, it seems to me that anyone who's here legally would have a passport with some kind of visa in it. And I'm wondering, you know, can't employers be sort of directed by the government in the different types of visas, and can't they just check the status that way? And I'll go off the air. But thank you very much.
Right.
Very informative.
No, thank you very much. I mean, the I-9 form, which is what the employer utilizes to be able to figure out identity and work authorization, does indeed target the passport as a document, for example, a U.S. passport that can establish both identity and work authorization. It's already there and being utilized. The problem you get into is when you rely too heavily right now on the Social Security card to be able to determine work authorization. When you're not looking at the visa that's issued by, for example, the State Department and the entry document issued by Department of Homeland Security, when I get out of that parameter in trying to figure out work authorization, for people. And instead, I rely heavily on the Social Security card, which is not tied to any biometric, which is not tied to these extensive pre-screening processes. That's where basically things become unhinged. And that's where, until we correct that, we're not going to be able to have a ready fix on employment verification. And some, to me, the best idea that I could come up with is that, yes, Social Security already has a link right now with Citizenship and Immigration Services, as well as with Customs and Border Protection. There's an enumeration at entry program where there's a linkage when the person comes in to have the information in this database that their work authorized. Again, the problem, though, is that Social Security card that is being produced in a mass of fraudulent documents, as well as the Social Security card that's for the child or the person who is deceased, et cetera, being able to identify that that really is not that person's card. So that's what we've got to hit.
Well, you know, we're at the point we're going to have to stop. My apologies. We have one person we can't take. We're just here at the end of the time. I appreciate you giving us your time. Obviously, this is a very difficult and complicated issue of many facets, and it sounds as if whenever at the national level we come around to talking about this again, we're going to be right where we are now, and still the most difficult issues, what are now the most difficult issues, are still going to be the most difficult issues. And it seems, I really wonder whether we're going to be any better positioned in another year or two to deal with them than we are now.
I agree. It's going to take a lot of a collective oversight and push to make any progress on the issue. But we've got to come to grips, finally, with what to do with the undocumented and not be quite so knee-jerk when we hear the A word, in my opinion.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Ms. Walker, for giving us some of your time. We certainly do appreciate it.
I had a good time. Thank you very much.
Our guest, Kathleen Campbell Walker. She is an attorney who specializes in immigration law. She currently is president of the American Immigration Lawyers Association, and she also is chair of the Immigration Department of the firm of Kemp Smith LLP in El Paso, where she has practiced law for more than 21 years. Support for this program, Focus 580, comes from the Infant Parent Institute, celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of children, young children, and their families. Information on the web at infantparent.com. We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of Alice and Robert Campbell. That's it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. There is much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we're going to talk with a fellow who is a farmer and a writer. His name is John Katz, and we will talk with him about his latest book, which is about life on his farm, Bedlam Farm, the title Dog Days, Dispatches from Bedlam Farm. Let's take a look now at commodity prices. In Kansas City, September wheat trading at 609.5, up 2.75. December, 623.5, up 2. In Chicago, September wheat, 620.5, up 1/2. December, 636.5, up 1.25. September corn, 319.5, down 1.75. December, 333.75, down 2.5. March, 349.5, down 2.25. December, 386, down 4. That's December 08. August soybeans, 848, down 8. September, 857, down 7.75. November, 874.5, down 7.5. November 08, 905, down 6.5. August meal, 220.